Stay tuned for The Turning Point with Mike Fader. This is Mike Fader with The Turning Point. That is broadcast every Monday at 4 p.m. on PRN.FM, which is what you're listening to right now. And after the broadcast, usually that same evening or the next day, it's available in podcast. If you want to get in touch with me about anything you hear on this program, best thing to do is go to my website, which is called the Fader Files, or Fader Files, FederFiles.com, FaderFiles.com. When you look for it online, it is currently undergoing major renovations, being torn down as a slum that it is and being rebuilt as a modern building. But you should still be able to access a place where you can get in touch with me or even join my mailing list. So far, I haven't really done any programs as a straight reaction or entire programs as reaction to what happened in Paris, basically because I've been so overwhelmed by it and other things have been going on. But today we're going to start to talk about some reactions that other people have had and that the world is having to what happened in Paris. Now it's, I think, what, 8, 9, 10 days ago? And there was an article in a place called Common Dreams, a wonderful online magazine that I've been reading for years, by Nadja Prupis. She is a journalist who works for Common Dreams. She's a staff writer there. And it says, after Paris, rights groups warn against knee-jerk national security overreach. And we have the writer of the article here, Nadja Prupis, is with us. Hiya.
Hi. Hi, how are you?
Okay, thanks for coming on.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Sure. maybe you could tell us a little bit before we start talking about the subject about what Common Dreams is, in case anybody's not familiar with it, and then I'll give people a tiny little bit of your background and we'll go on to the article.
Sure. So Common Dreams is a progressive news outlet. We cover mostly international and larger picture domestic issues, but sometimes we do get to cover smaller, more local stories. But we do everything with from a progressive lens.
Mm-hmm. And you've been there for about, a year and a half now?
Yeah, about a year and a half.
And let's see what it says here. Before on your bio, you had a reporting fellowship with Truthout, which is another terrific outlet. And you've been published in The Nation, New America Media, Ms. Magazine, and other outlets. And before joining Common Dreams, you lived and worked on a literacy development project in Kenya. What was that, a literacy development project in Kenya?
That was with an NGO. We worked in tandem with two schools in these developing villages in Mombasa, helping them to become self-sustaining and develop a core English curriculum for students who are in need and impacted by disease and poverty.
Must have been quite an experience, right?
Indeed, quite an experience.
Well, there are a million different kinds and levels of reactions to what happened in Paris, from emotional to political to military to racial to legal. And the article that you wrote, it really concerns basically a lot of European reactions, European government and European leaders' reactions to what happens in Paris. And but we could also throw in a little bit, and you do in the article, about reactions that have extended over here. And basically, what they're saying is, what they're saying and what they're doing, like in France, is they're declaring a national emergency, like after 9/11 here, and turning the Constitution upside down, or maybe just sort of ripping it to shreds. You know,
one after the other.
Yeah, one after the other. Well, whatever in sequence. I mean, like, you know, we had the Patriot Act, and the president's got his own private army anyhow for a long time, so that's not a question. But so in France, which previously or for a long time now has been very proud of its liberté, égalité, and fraternité, and as in their constitution, is now rethinking that. So they're in a state of emergency, correct? What does that mean exactly?
The state of emergency?
Yeah, for France.
Well, it gives the intelligence and police agencies extended and very expansive powers to conduct unwarranted house searches, to monitor phone calls and emails. It gives them some similar sort of surveillance and other powers that allow them to conduct.
Didn't they have a lot of, they must have had a lot of this in place before, because they've had threats and attacks before. I mean, do they already have a kind of NSA surveillance over there like we have here?
They do. In January, they passed, following the Charlie Hebdo attacks, they passed another law. They passed this similar to the Patriot Act, this legislation that gives them this power to sweep up and analyze metadata, authorize surveillance, and even hack into suspect phones and computers for reasons that are as vague as major foreign policy interests or preventing organized delinquency.
Organized delinquency.
Exactly.
Because what's happened in this country, I mean, you could see it with the Occupy movement, but just in general, if there is any organized protest at all, like there used to be forever in this country, except during an actual state of war, anybody who gathers anywhere now and tries to oppose any kind of war that we're conducting in this country, or whatever economic policy or income inequality, is automatically labeled as criminal.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And we've seen here in the States anyway that law enforcement agencies have been repeatedly exposed as having spied on human rights activists and other movements that are critical of the government, in, as you said, in whatever way, whether it's war or, you know, with Occupy Wall Street, it was the economic policies and foreign policies. It doesn't take a huge leap in logic to see the dangers of allowing that kind of vague language and that depth of power.
Well, they could probably take a look at what's happened in this country, although I don't think here yet. I mean, there's all kinds of spying that goes on and a tremendous shift in the way the American government. And when I say the American government, I make sure to say the American government, because I don't think it really represents the majority will of the people of the United States.
No, of course not. No, I don't think so either. I think most people are. Yeah, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say, I think most people who have some basic understanding of what these expansive surveillance programs really entail would absolutely oppose them because they're out of control.
But if, in fact, or maybe already, if Hollande proposed these things to the is it called the Parliament? I mean, what is it? What is the national body, the legislative body in France?
It's Parliament, yeah.
Parliament. If he proposes these to the Parliament, they're probably going to go along with him, the same way that this stuff got railroaded through Congress here after 9/11.
Well, I think that, I mean, that's certainly possible. And it's hard to say so soon after the attacks what the national feeling there is like. Mm-hmm. And the French having been sort of historically more of a truly democratic, not truly democratic, but certainly more so than the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe their baseline for the way that they approach and analyze and act on legislation like this could be with slightly more reason and less emotion-based rhetoric.
Maybe they all wouldn't feel like they were branded traitors if they even wanted to read the bill in the first place, right?
Right. Right. Yeah. But it's hard to say. I mean, it's possible that it would pass in Parliament because people vote. Parliament is obviously a much smaller representation of the public, so it's hard to say. I mean, it wouldn't shock me. It would not shock me.
Now, what's happening in England? I know Prime Minister Cameron announced that, according to your article, that they would add almost 2,000 new security and intelligence staff. But there is also something called the Investigatory Powers Bill. Now, what would that be?
So that's this bill that's been sort of advancing and stopping and starting through British Parliament for a while now, for a couple of years. And it's the critics refer to it as sort of the snooper's charter because it gives perhaps the most invasive powers in any Western country to their security and intelligence agencies. Just virtually unaccountable. License to spy on
their own citizens.
On their own citizens. It would be unprecedented.
I mean, what, more than what goes on in this country?
Yeah.
Now everybody also is aware of the fact that the CIA director Brennan has warned that the Paris attacks should serve as a wake up call to surveillance opponents. I mean, the people like, you know, Brennan and other people in the government are disgusted by the slight pullback from mass surveillance, that occurred after Snowden, made his revelations.
Right.
But now they are using this opportunity, and it says here in your article that he called this, the attacks should serve as a wake-up call to surveillance opponents, and criticized, quote, a number of unauthorized disclosures and a lot of hand-wringing over the government's role in the effort to try to uncover these terrorists. So I think probably what will happen here is that the progress that was made by the, in a lot of federal courts to pull back on this mega data gathering and everything may be reversed. Do you think so?
I think that the outcry, the backlash from the Snowden revelations was strong enough that, that at least the proposals to expand a surveillance legislation would have some pushback from the courts. But I also think it's true that the government, as we know, has a lot of power that can't be legislated by courts, or is legislated by courts like the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, which is simply an arm of the spy operation.
It's a rubber stamp, more or less, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Its purpose is to authorize everything that the intelligence agencies want to do.
I think I read somewhere that something like 97% or 98% of the requests from the FBI are approved by the FISA courts, something like
that. Yeah, it's true. I think that they have a lot of options whether or not the civil courts, approve or support this kind of legislation or not.
Well, now, maybe just to be the devil's advocate here, what happened on 9/11 in this country and what happened in Paris the other day? Now, there are other questions involved here, too. These kinds of things have been happening all over the world almost routinely every week or two, practically, in some other place in the Middle East or Afghanistan or Pakistan or Africa or someplace. I mean, even in Kenya, where you worked.
Right.
Last April, I think it was the Shabab, Somalian terrorist group, attacked a college and killed, they just murdered in cold blood 150 students. So this is happening all over the place. And the countries where this is happening, do they have, like a place like Pakistan, for instance, they have extremely harsh laws. I mean, there's no real democracy in Pakistan, right? But it happens there anyhow. So, I mean, because one of the things you, the reason I mentioned that is because one of the things you say in your article is the attacks in Paris happened even despite the fact that they, you know, have an expansive surveillance law, and you don't even know what the authorities are capable of doing or what they have been doing. Are you suggesting that increased surveillance really doesn't make a difference when it comes to attacks like this?
Yeah, it doesn't make a difference. So after the Snowden leak in 2013, President Obama created this this review board of these kinds of sweeping intelligence laws. And I'm sorry to keep referring to it that way, but that's really just the best shorthand for it. And this review group, which was formed on the order of the president himself, they found after extensive research that the telephone metadata program, which was authorized by the Patriot Act, was not helpful in thwarting any terrorist plots whatsoever, and that the monitoring of certain phone calls that that ended up being useful in some other investigation could have been obtained through traditional methods of getting court orders for wiretaps.
So there's no, I mean, but we really don't know. I mean, people like Brennan and other people in various governments, and especially in our government, are always saying, you don't know how many horrible attacks we've stopped. That's right. We don't know. Maybe it would help if we did know, wouldn't it?
It would help. And I wonder if the number is high or if it's low. And as far as Brennan's comments about the unauthorized disclosures and the hand-wringing, I think it's important to also recognize that that is a wildly offensive statement for a number of reasons. not the least of which because it implicitly blames us, the people, the ones who were being spied on unlawfully, and when we became aware of it, stood up and said, don't do that, for the Paris attacks for Charlie Hebdo, and if ever some other attack happens on Western shores, because he's not talking about Beirut or Garissa, then that's our fault, too. So he's putting a standing order of blame for large-scale terrorist attacks on people who think that civil liberties and democracy are more important than secret government surveillance.
So his attitude is we're just a bunch of liberal airheads who, and ideologues who really don't understand the real threat. And if we understood it, we'd all fall in line, right? That's his attitude.
Right. And also he's suggesting that you know, dissent, which he calls hand-wringing, is making it more challenging for the CIA to uncover terrorist plots. But if that's true, then it sounds like the real problem is that the American intelligence sector is bad at its job.
Mm-hmm.
And in that case, it's pretty absurd to suggest that we have blood on our hands and they don't.
Maybe he would be happier in a country that has maybe closer to the Saudi model than our model. You know, I mean, maybe because, right. But I'm trying to understand everybody in my old age, and I'm trying to be more understanding. I mean, the guy's in charge of the CIA. He knows about things and he sees things that are happening that maybe we really don't see. All I ask is, as a member of a democracy, as a citizen of what's supposed to be a democracy, that if he's claiming all this, then prove it to me. And if you can't prove it to me, then shut up about the hand-wringing, you know.
Right. I think that's a very fair ask.
But he says he can't because it's concerns security leaks. But then,
right. It's sort of an absurd Orwellian sort of tactic.
Yeah.
That the intelligence and military agencies used previously in 2002 and 2003 to galvanize public support for the war on terror, which is why we're here now, with troops in Afghanistan and Iraq and now in perhaps in Syria any day now. The war on terror, as we've learned over the past 14 years, hasn't killed terrorism. There are clearly still terrorists.
It all depends what you call the Taliban, but they're pretty terrifying to me from what I hear from other sources, like, you know, Ann Jones and the head of Women for Afghan Women. I mean, it's pretty awful. The Taliban is pretty awful. But they are resurgent. They control something like, 70% of Afghanistan. I heard that the in Afghanistan, they refer to the president of Afghanistan as the mayor of Kabul. That's it, you know.
I had not heard that.
Well, but that's, this is what's going on, is that these things don't... Something has got to control these people, and I don't know what it is. I mean, hardly anybody knows what it is, and it's a complicated issue. But it all comes down to, and this is something I want to ask you, too. It's a question I'm going to save to the end, and we can discuss it a little bit. And I just want your opinion, not necessarily based on facts, about how much, how far do you trade in, or how many civil liberties do you trade in for security? Because these people are sort of out of control, like mad dogs, you know, whoever they are, whatever they're, if they state that they have a goal, it doesn't make any difference. Their goal is just power and violence and lust and greed or whatever, like anybody else. But, like any other, you know, even Western, specifically Western power. But one thing you said in your article here is you quoted a European human. Oh, by the way, if you just tuned in, my guest is Nadja Prupis, who is a staff writer for Common Dreams, and she writes frequent articles for Common Dreams. If you haven't checked Common Dreams, go to Common Dreams online. They always have a wonderful set of articles about international topics and about larger topics of larger concern. It's a wonderful.
That's .org, by the way.
Oh yeah, CommonDreams.org.
Thank you.
One of the paragraphs here in here, it says European human rights group Liberty added. Is that a particular to a country, Liberty, or is it just European?
I think they're based in the UK, but they do transcontinental work. They have advocates in many different countries.
Well, it says that you quoted them. The French authorities are no doubt right to look to the country's security, and there must be unity and cooperation amongst all democratic nations of our shrinking planet. And here's the essence of it, though. But that unity ultimately comes from shared values and security from the knowledge that whilst closed, oppressive societies breed hatred and barbarism, open, reflective societies built on rights, freedoms, and the rule of law ultimately prevail.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that's probably true, but the key phrase there for me is shared values. The people who are making these attacks, like ISIS and the people, and they're all over the place, and then Al-Qaeda and Shabab or whoever, they don't have the same values at all that people in democracies have. So, you know, we only have a few minutes, but how do you protect against that? And are you saying that increased surveillance or giving up civil liberties and civil rights is not the way to do that?
Yeah, this is my opinion section.
Sure.
Checking if that was what you're looking for.
Yeah, I just want to hear what you looked into this and you're a citizen and you're aware and awake and everything. Well, I mean, what's your feeling? I mean, you know, you're an American. What do you think about that?
I think personally that civil liberties are never negotiable. And I think what we've learned over the past 14 years, if a citizen, not necessarily one who works in news, but who's paying attention to the right news, to alternative voices, has learned that war and restriction of rights does little to affect lasting peaceful change.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an old trope, but it's fitting to say you can't bomb democracy into existence. We, in order to protect ourselves against becoming targets of terrorists, we need to withdraw ourselves from their territory. We've been using military force against terrorism, as I said, for over a decade now, and it has failed over and over and over.
But is it creating more terrorism?
It's also what it's doing is destabilizing the regions where those groups have such a strong presence. The vacuum that is created when you bomb one funeral or one wedding and kill one terrorist, maybe, amongst hundreds of civilians.
Mm-hmm. Or shoot up a hospital in Kunduz.
Right, or shoot up a hospital, exactly.
But
because that's where they hide, right? By doing so, you create further... by further destabilizing these regions, you create a territory where there are no opportunities, where life is a constant struggle for survival. And in this way, you breed discontent for the West, who are the powers that are oppressing these nations.
Well, we only have like about like a minute or so left, but these people really are dangerous, and I don't think that what you're saying, I agree with what you're saying. I mean, that's the ideal situation, and that's the idea, and it's the practical thing to do is just stop destabilizing these places, stop invading, stop bombing them all and creating all this trouble. But these people are capable on their own because of their own particular lunacy, which sometimes has nothing to do with what any Western powers, that they're capable of doing this. isn't there some, and the people who are supposed to protect us, the police and let's say the FBI or whatever the equivalent is in some European country, they have to be able to deal with these people, correct?
They do, but the other issue there is that terrorists, for much, much longer than anyone has ever known about the NSA spying operations, for much longer than any of that information has been public, have been using encrypted communications to evade intelligence surveillance.
Mm-hmm.
So increased surveillance of ordinary citizens is not going to help the FBI, the CIA, the NSA, or any other Western intelligence service find and intercept encrypted communication.
So you're saying basically, to get to the root of the problems, we have to stop terrorizing, or we have to stop being the terrorists in these other countries so we don't create an endless back and forth and buildup of terrorism.
Yes, I think that is essentially the best solution, is stop terrorizing other people.
Okay, thank you very much. Nadja Prupas from Common Dreams, and she writes frequent articles on there. And check out commondreams.org. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Sure. Thank you for coming on. We're going to take a break now, and hopefully we have another guest to talk to about reactions in this country and some blowback against various people in this country to the attacks in Paris. Let's go to some music, and then we'll get a guest on the line. Okay, Mike Fader again, and on The Turning Point. Once again, if you want to get in touch with me about any of the issues you hear on this program or any other reason, you can go to my website, FaderFiles, FederFiles.com. And though it's somewhat in a shambles now because I'm reconstructing it, you should still be able to contact me through there and join my mailing list, too. We have with us today Ibrahim Hooper, who is the National Communications Director and Spokesperson of CAIR, that's C-A-I-R, which is the Council on American-Islamic Relations. And thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. Now, you didn't just suddenly materialize as the National Communications Director there. You had a career leading up to that. I mean, can you give us a little background on yourself there?
Oh, I generally come from a journalism background. I've got a master's in journalism and mass communication, and I did nonprofit public relations in other organizations, and I worked as television news producer, field producer, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. And the organization itself, Council on American Islamic Relations, when was that formed, and what specifically is, generally, are its purposes and goals?
Well, we were formed back in 1994 as a Muslim civil rights organization. I guess you could compare us to kind of Muslim ADL or Muslim NAACP, mm-hmm, or that kind of thing, representing the civil rights of American Muslims and others, by the way. and building coalitions that promote justice, you know, with like-minded organizations of all the, across the spectrum.
And how is your organization funded? Is it individual donations, or how does the money come in to run the organization?
Yeah, exclusively individual donations. We don't take. Well, we're not offered government money, so I guess we don't take it there. But yeah, it's individuals who support our mission and you know, fund us that way.
Council on American Islamic Relations. Now, specifically, does that mean the relationship of American people to?
Sometimes I wonder if we'd the name. Might have been better, but that's what we picked right in the beginning, because it's some people would say, well, it creates some kind of dichotomy between American and being American and a Muslim, but it's obviously not intended that way. We view American Muslims as productive citizens of our nation, and we just seek to enhance understanding of Islam and the American Muslim experience.
Could you estimate roughly how many Americans are Muslims?
Well, we think about 6 to 7 million, but truthfully, nobody knows for sure. Mm-hmm. The Islamophobes will say there's 6 Muslims in America, but they're all trying to take over the country, you know. Mm-hmm. And the Muslims sometimes exaggerate, you know, 10, 15 million. So, you know, it's perhaps the most diverse religious community in America, and therefore it's just hard to get a handle on it because census doesn't ask for religion. It's very difficult to get a handle. And then what do you consider a Muslim? Do you consider a Muslim who hasn't been, someone a Muslim who hasn't been to a mosque in 10 years, yet if you ask them what's your faith, they'd say Islam? Mm-hmm. Or do you only consider people who go to a mosque on a regular basis and, you know, this kind of thing? So it's the same dilemma for churched and unchurched Christians and that kind of thing.
Yeah, and Jews too. I mean, you know, people people ask me, am I Jewish? Yeah, I'm Jewish, but what does that mean? I haven't been really to a synagogue for services for decades. So, but I still, you know, so
yeah,
I understand.
If you're asked what your faith is, that's what you would say,
Mm-hmm. Now, to get down to cases here, there have been astounding, of course, extreme reactions by a lot of people in the world, and some for good reason, you know, afraid for their security and after the Paris attacks. And it's not just the Paris attacks, too. And this is another issue to address at length in some other way. But and as I mentioned to an earlier guest I was talking to, these kinds of horrifying things have happened almost every couple of weeks, or maybe even more frequently, all over the world, in the Middle East, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Africa.
Yeah, but I mean, you have a Paris occurring almost every day in Syria when Assad helicopters drop barrel bombs on markets in Syria. You have it occurring in Iraq. You have it in Korea. And every day these things are happening. You know, and I would hope that we would assign the same value to human life wherever it is, whether it's in Paris or, Aleppo or in Baghdad.
Well, now that's a consummation devoutly to be wished. That's human, but it seems like it's almost human nature. And I don't want to get into a whole philosophical discussion here, but inevitably it involves racism. But also it seems to be human nature that people will identify with people who seem to resemble them one way or another. And I think a lot of the reaction by you Western European countries and by a lot of Americans is what happened to a lot of white European people, you know. So now I don't want to set off a whole barrel bomb of responses here as far as racism and everything goes, but reactions by politicians in France and England, you can see what that is, reaction by the government and by people because they're scared to death. But then there's also people who take advantage of this, you know, the military industrial complex and people who provide surveillance equipment and weapons and mercenaries. But reactions by politicians, I want to limit it to this country because it's the Council on American Islamic Relations. Have there been, first of all, reactions by the general public, put it that way. It's a pleasant way to put it. Have there been threats, death threats, acts of violence?
I mean, as I'm sitting here, I'm drafting a news release about us calling on the FBI and local law enforcement in Cincinnati to investigate an attempt to kill a Muslim woman in the street in Cincinnati as a hate crime. A guy shouted terrorist and other slurs and obscenities at this Muslim woman in a headscarf, a med student, tried to run her down. We just had an assault on a Muslim woman on a campus in San Diego. We've had vandalism at mosques. We had a mosque in Canada burnt. We've had shots fired at mosques, shots fired at Muslim family homes, innumerable death threats and hate-filled letters to mosques and to Muslims around the country. So we unfortunately have seen a real spike in anti-Muslim hate crimes in the wake of the Paris attacks.
Well, it obviously does not help when you have almost every one of the, and a couple of cases, really extreme cases, of the Republican candidates for the nomination, some of the things they've said are outrageous. I mean, they are incitement to riot. And
you wonder if you're in pre-war Nazi Germany sometimes when Donald Trump says he's going to shut down mosques, he's going to create a database of American Muslims, he's going to make American Muslims have special IDs marking their religion. Mm. I mean, that goes back to the 1930s.
Carson, right? Carson,
no, that was Trump.
Yeah, Carson
called Syrian refugees mad dogs. He said a Muslim shouldn't be president of the United States. I mean, we have our kids now asking, Muslim kids asking their parents, if when the new president comes, what's going to happen to us? Are they going to put us in camps? Are they going to kick us out of the country? Kids are asking these questions.
Well, it's not unknown, although it was a very different set of circumstances in many ways that America did put some people in camps at one point in our not-so-distant past, right? So,
we have local politicians. I think it was in Missouri, a state official or a lawmaker suggested internment camps for the Syrian refugees. We got a guy, a state lawmaker in Tennessee, saying that the National Guard should go round up existing Syrian refugees in the state to deal with them. I mean, it's beyond comprehension, and we're not getting pushback from our national leaders on this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, President Bush went to a mosque, American mosque, after 9/11. We haven't seen President Obama go to a mosque in a show of solidarity in America. He's never been to an American mosque.
Mm-hmm. What is it? Something like, last I read, it was something like 25 or 26 state governors have declared that they will not accept Syrian refugees. And
it's up to 30 now.
And there was one, I think it was the governor of Indiana actually turned away some people who would...
Yeah, he turned away a Syrian refugee family that had to go to Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
It's unbelievable.
Now,
imagine you've just fled terrorism and oppression in Syria with the Assad and the ISIS, and you get to America, land of the free, and the governor of the state says he doesn't want you in his state.
Does he have a legal right to do that?
Apparently not, but again, with the lack of pushback from our nation's leaders, I guess they do what they want.
Mm-hmm. Well, in other words, the Justice Department would have to intercede in a case like that, but they're not doing anything about it.
Yeah, I'm not an attorney, but you would think so.
Not to sound naive or anything, but why pick on the Syrian refugees? I mean, the last I heard
because
is there was one of the terrorists had
it. It panders to the right-wing base. You see Donald Trump. Why does Donald Trump say thousands of New Jersey Muslims were cheering 9/11 when it didn't occur?
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what his supporters want to hear. That when they read their anti-Muslim hate sites, that's what they see. So they wanted it reflected back to them.
I think anything they can grab onto, obviously. These people are really desperate and really out of control. I'm specifically talking about these candidates. And for the governors to say things like this is really absurd. Last I heard was that one of the attackers or one of the suspected attackers that were killed by the Paris authorities, by the police or whatever, had a Syrian passport. And even that is somewhat doubtful. It may not have even been a legitimate passport.
Yeah, I mean, one thing they forget, in America, more people have been killed by right-wing extremists than have been killed by Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
Yet you don't hear much about the danger of right-wing extremists, do you?
Well, you do hear about it. I mean, if you pay attention to the right places.
If you pay attention.
Yeah. Now, I'm sure that a lot of people are expecting, this is what always happens, because I've experienced this as a Jew, too, about Israel, right? Like, you know, people sometimes say to me, like, in a somewhat aggressive way, you know, what do you think about Israel? And, you know, yeah, what do I think about Israel? That's a foreign country. You know what I mean? Those are other people. They don't represent me. But the same thing must be happening with an organization like yours, or people who are in some position of authority or spokespeople for Muslims, right? In other words, show us how you are not one of these people. You have to prove that.
Yeah, I mean, you're forced into the when did you stop being your wife kind of scenario,
right?
It's not helpful. I mean, how many times do we have to be told go back where you came from? Well, I'm from the Midwest, not the Mideast.
Mm-hmm. Well, go back where you came from, and as far as the refugees, there was this is something that a lot of people know, but there was an op-ed piece by Nicholas Kristof in the Times the other day, pointing out, as many people have pointed out, that and it just starts off like this: desperate refugees flee persecution and war, but American politicians, worried about security risks, refuse to accept them. And this is the first paragraph. That's the situation today, but it's also the shameful way we responded as Jews were fleeing Nazi Germany in the 1930s.
But you know, always they have an answer to this. When Mark Levin is, you know, the hate-filled radio host, when he is challenged, oh no, it's different because Muslims truly are dangerous. They always have the fallback. Well, yeah, it wasn't right to intern Japanese Americans. It wasn't right to turn Jews away, you know, on ships when they would come fleeing Nazi Germany. But it is right to do that to Muslims now because Islam is inherently evil and Muslims are horrible. So, you know, they always have an answer for it.
Now, having said that, having talked about this problem, does your organization have an official position or any kind of stated position on groups like ISIS and other groups like that?
I mean, we're a signatory to an open letter to ISIS signed by more than 120, well, I'm sure it's hundreds now, scholars, religious leaders, Muslim scholars, religious leaders from around the world, refuting their extremist ideology point by point. We've issued innumerable condemnations of ISIS, their extremist views, and we call them not only un-Islamic, we call them anti-Islamic views.
Mm-hmm.
We've done the same for any number of terrorist attacks and things over the years. So, every time I go on a program, somebody says, why haven't Muslims spoken out against terrorism? Well, I guess you're not listening, because mm-hmm. we have consistently and we have repeated.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Ibrahim Hooper, who is the National Communications Director and spokesperson for CAIR, C-A-I-R, Council on American Islamic Relations. And what's your website?
CAIR.com. We didn't get the org because some California Association of Insurance Retailers, I think, got it 20-some years ago, but CAIR.com.
Okay. One of the reactions, there's been all kinds of reactions, and you could see in Europe what the reactions are. I mean, emergency powers suspending various parts of the Constitution, and there's always this argument about how much civil liberty do you trade in a democracy to protect yourself? And unfortunately, it's a whole lot. I mean, in the United States, after 9/11, it's as if the government has become like a separate institution that doesn't really connect with its own citizens, but basically represents a kind of threat to its own citizens in terms of, you know, what used to be a democracy. But people like John Brennan and other people are calling on the government to resume and even increase surveillance of American citizens, which includes, of course, any American citizen, Muslim American citizens. What's your opinion about this kind of reaction?
We're obviously against warrantless surveillance. If you know that somebody or you suspect somebody is up to wrongdoing, you know, get a warrant and do surveillance on them. But this thing of just broad metadata or whatever, round up the usual suspect surveillance, obviously we join other civil rights organizations in opposing that.
Mm-hmm. I don't think it's ever been shown to work. And as I was talking with my earlier guest, I mean, people like Brennan are always saying, you have no idea how much this surveillance has helped us in preventing horrible things from happening. Well, you know what? This is supposed to be a democracy. It's supposed to be a free and open society. If you show me, prove it to me, then maybe I'll reconsider my position. But I haven't. Well, no, I can't do that. It's classified. So there we are. Right? You know.
Yeah.
I mean, you know.
It's a very convenient position for them.
Well, anyhow, if people are victims or have been victims of threats or attacks or anything like that, does your organization provide help and assistance for them? And how would they do? How would they approach you?
Yeah, we have a number of lawyers, civil rights attorneys nationwide. And if anybody has suffered bias or discrimination or a hate crime, they should contact one of our offices or our national office. They can file a report online through CAIR.com, and they can email me directly, ihooper@CAIR.com. I made the mistake of giving out my email one time on a Fox News interview.
Oh, no.
I got inundated with hundreds of hostile and threatening emails, but I'm assuming that's not your audience.
I don't think that's going to happen here. Well, you think about what happened with the Japanese, and there wasn't much of a protest there during World War II, but these kinds of things happen. I mean, people do get scared.
When people are frightened, weird things happen.
That's right. People get scared, and what happened in Paris is pretty scary. But like you said earlier, it's been happening almost every day all over the world. And I suppose one last thing to say is, although it's a complicated and complex issue, and it involves just basic human fear, is the reaction in this country and in Western European countries, but particularly in this country, from a lot of people who are in charge, who are really the descendants of Western Europeans? I don't want to give you the answer while I'm asking the question, but I mean, are we talking about racism here, in other words, or is it just merely a question of distance and routine? I mean, we've been reading about these horrible massacres and bombings and marketplaces.
Well, I think it goes back to what you said in the beginning, that people tend to care more about people that are like themselves than about other people. That's just almost a human instinct, sometimes good, sometimes bad. Mm-hmm. So I think that's probably what's going on.
Okay. Well, listen, thanks for coming on the show.
All right. Thank you.
And that's CAIR, CARE, Council on American Islamic Relations. Okay. We're just about out of time here. There will be more shows about my personal reactions to what happened in Paris, and maybe a couple of other guests that I'll interview. Also, I am revamping my website, but I am currently writing a rather long essay, which I will put on my website. And if you wanted to join my mailing list, I will let everybody know when that's available to read. When I say long, I mean, you know, like 6-7 pages. But I think there are universal reactions that involve fear and anger. And, we identify with people who like ourselves and all kinds of things to talk about here. This is also a war we can't win by sending troops in. A million things to talk about. So go to faderfiles.com and see if you can get yourself on the mailing list and contact me if you want about this. Okay, that's it for this week.
through the garden, you better watch your back. Well, I beg your pardon, walk a straight and narrow track. If you walk with Jesus, he'll save your soul. You gotta keep the devil down in the hole. He's got the fire and the fury at his command. Well, you don't have to worry if you hold on to Jesus' hand. We'll all be safe from Satan when the thunder rolls. You gotta keep the devil. Temptation.